And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to have Mark Greaney back on the program today. Mark is a New York Times bestselling author of international thrillers. He co-authored several Jack Ryan novels with Tom Clancy and has continued the series after Mr. Clancy's passing, the most recent one being True Faith and Allegiance. Mark is also the author of the Gray Man series, starring former CIA goon Court Gentry. Today we'll talk about book six in that series, Gunmetal Gray. Now, Mark, even though we've talked about Court Gentry several times before, for those new to him, could you explain to us why he's called the Gray Man?
That's actually a term, sort of a standard term you hear a lot in the special operations community, or I guess in the spy world, that just means someone who's very low profile and kind of slips under the radar. If he's in the military, he's dressed as a civilian, but he's not wearing the telltale civilian clothing that lots of guys in the military wear. Or if he's a spy or something, he just looks like the businessman sitting next to you on the train. That is the genesis of why he's called that. But he specifically, the Gray Man at the Court Gentry, is a guy in his late 30s who was basically raised in the CIA. He was pulled into the CIA when he was still a teenager, 19 years old, and trained to be a singleton asset, a guy that works totally on his own without a net. And he's just over 20 years or so, he's worked in the Special Activities Division, which is the paramilitary arm of the CIA ground branch. He's just spent a life in the field, so better than most people, he's able to remain very, very low profile. Now he spent the last 5 years working away from the CIA as a freelance assassin. In this book, he's returned to work on a contract basis with the CIA. So he's really honed these abilities to keep himself alive with his personal security better than most.
Because when he was with the CIA originally, his team's call sign was Golf Sierra, mm-hmm. but they were commonly known as the Goon Squad.
Yeah, the Goon Squad. And that was the first book you realized that this is a guy that had been on a team called the Goon Squad or the Task Force Golf Sierra. And for reasons that he didn't understand, his whole team turned on him and he had to fight his way out of that team. And since then, he'd been on the run from the CIA. That got somewhat resolved in the last book. And so now he has this very tenuous, somewhat adversarial contract relationship with the CIA. So it's only turned into a deeper, murkier relationship.
The kill on sight order has kind of been rescinded, but still, he's still technically a wanted man.
Exactly. The CIA has realized that he's very good at what he does, and there's a benefit to him being the ultimate deniable asset because the whole world knows that the CIA is after him. And so they're actually not after him, but they're leaving that shoot on sight out there. They're just not actively sending people out there. And their plan is to use him for these real deniable operations because he's the last person that people would associate with the CIA.
Now, he really only has two points of contact within the CIA as it is now, and that's his handler, Suzanne Brewer. She's very talented and super ambitious, and she doesn't care one way or the other if Gentry lives, essentially.
Yeah. Not only does she not care, she would probably love for him to be hit by a bus so she could get out of this. She doesn't like being in the position she's in, but due to circumstances that have happened in the previous book, Backblast, and go into this book, Gunmetal Gray is very much a standalone book, and you really realize quickly these sort of fractured relationships that are being maintained out of necessity. Brewer is someone who is put in the position of being the Gray Man's handler, and it's the last thing in the world she wants to do, but she's very good at her job, and she's doing it, and she's using him as a tool with no more moral obligation to keep him alive. He's a tool to her, and she would love to wiggle her way out of this situation, but this is the situation she finds herself in, and it makes things tougher for our hero because you realize the hero thinks he's working with a net, but Suzanne Brewer is not much of a net.
So what was the challenge like for you in the first several books? Each of them very much had a standalone aspect to them, but they're always kind of advancing the idea of Gentry wants to know why
right. The
CIA wants to kill him. Why did his team turn on him? And now you've answered some of these questions to a great extent. How do you see yourself going forward and being an arc for Gentry?
Yeah, it was always fun for me to make each book a standalone. So each book has its, contained story arc, but you also have this larger story arc, sort of a payoff for people that have stuck with the series or have picked up the earlier books in the series. So I wanted to sort of create the best of both worlds because I'm a big reader and I love reading series of books, and I love it when there's a recurring thing that's going on throughout the books. But if the first Frederick Forsyth I pick up is book 8, I don't want to, have to read the first 7 books. you know, as a writer, you're lucky that people read your books at all. So you never go back and command them, you know, say you have to read the first seven before you pick this one up or something. But that first five book story arc, I felt like it was time to pay it off by the fifth book and not leave these things hanging. So that story was completely resolved in Backblast and set up Gunmetal Grey, which is book six. And this book starts almost a new storyline where he is this contract operative of the CAA. It is, as I said, a difficult relationship. They might have similar goals in general, but it's hard to know who to trust and how these things are going to play out, whether he's being used as a pawn or whether he's actually the king. He's the one that making the decisions, and there's a lot of that. So this story arc will maybe go five books. I don't know for sure, but there is a direction larger than the books, you know, this individual book that will continue on. So hopefully what I do is I've created a new sort of world for him to live in for a period of time with new realities, and hopefully that'll get resolved at some point as well.
Now, in those original books, he was a singleton operator and an assassin, but he had his own ethical code. And right. Now that he has employers,
right,
that ethical code may not be respected.
That's exactly right. And as I was writing this book, I didn't have this as a grand plan, but as I was writing this book, I thought it might be interesting for there to be parts where even the reader might disagree with the hero's conclusions and on a few things. So there's parts in this book where not everybody who reads it is going to think that Court Gentry is doing exactly the right thing for the right reasons. But he has this moral code, which I felt I had to be true to, whether or not it was what everybody wanted to read. So he does things in this book where some of the readers, I guess, might say, wow, you know, I think the CIA is probably right here and he needs to dial it back a notch, or maybe he should do this for, you know, a greater good or something like that. But he's a guy that maybe questions himself a lot, but ultimately he has this fractured moral compass that doesn't point true north. But I mean, he definitely has ethics that he believes in. So he's a working stiff now to a degree. But there is a lot of pushback between him and the CIA about what he thinks should be done.
Now, over the years, you've done a lot of travel to research the areas that Gentry travels to, done a lot of tactical and weapons training so you know how the fight should go down. How do you go about exploring that ethical area, since I'm guessing in your everyday life you're not faced with those challenges?
That's true. I read a lot of nonfiction, so I delve into, and I know some people in law enforcement and special operations and some people from the intelligence world, and I don't necessarily interview them specifically about the ethical quandaries, but I listen to them, and people offer up things about situations they've been in or their viewpoints. So I think maybe I've created this moral compass out of experiences I've had and just things I've read about, and what this guy who's lived this life and obviously has this psychological baggage, which I think about a lot. You know, he's not a guy that just swings in on a rope and machine guns everybody and James Bond has a martini afterwards. There's repercussions for the things that happen in the stories. So I do think about it a lot. And then I just pull this code from people that I've met and talked to. And then after, you know, we're on book six, I feel like I know him really well now. So as I said before, there's a part in this book where a lot of the readers might think that they would choose something else other than what he chooses. And it was just interesting to me to explore that. We'll see what readers think about it.
But I have seen some of your personal experience bleed into the book, and not in Court Gentry's character, but in Suzanne Brewer, because she's dealing with a foot or lower leg injury in the book.
That's true. It's funny that I wrote Backblast before I hurt my ankle. So it is sort of coincidental. But then, I had a couple of ankle surgeries this year, and I've been on a knee scooter and I've been on crutches more this year than off them. I was writing Gunmetal Grey before some of this stuff had happened. So yeah, it was a little bit coincidental, but then as I got into it, I became an expert on dealing with lower leg injury. And since Suzanne Brewer had injured her lower leg in Backblast, it worked in pretty good. I mean, if she'd broken her neck or something, I wouldn't have much to say about it other than doing some research. But my research was 24/7 on that aspect.
Did it make her a little bit more sympathetic to you as a character?
Yeah, or maybe it made me want to sort of talk about her sympathetically, whether or not she's a sympathetic character. You sort of have to read the book, but I think maybe she's going to be looked at that way because she's dealing with this personal struggle. Although if you've read Backblast, you might not feel terribly sorry for her because her leg injury came as a result of her own actions. So it's like a lot of things in the gray man world. There's murky. It's not white and black. It's very gray, the story.
Now, his other contact at the agency is very well placed, Matthew Hanley. He's the director of National Clandestine Services. Now, what are the responsibilities that go along with that job title?
Well, if you're the head of NCS, you are in charge of all operations. So it used to be called the director of operations, but it's called the director of National Clandestine Service. So you are over the case officers, the spies that run around the world that work in the embassies or work non-official cover. You're also over the Special Activities Division, which is the paramilitary arm of the CIA. So if you're the head of NCS, you are the head of all the spies, all operations for the CIA, as opposed to the analytical side or the administrative side. So Matt Hanley has been in the books, in the first five books, in several places. He started out as the head of the goon squad, sort of the suit that ran the goon squad. He wasn't a shooter on the ground. He was the guy that came in and gave them their assignments. And then from that, he grew from there. And then when Court Gentry shot his way out of the goon squad, he was sort of demoted, became the station chief in Haiti, and which was not the top billing for a CIA officer. But then things that happened in the series sort of helped his stock rise up and up and up. And then at the end of Backblast, he becomes the head of NCS. So he is a sympathetic guy to Court Gentry, but it's a murky situation. You get the feeling that Matt Hanley would take a bullet for Gentry, but at the same time, Matt Hanley would send Gentry off to his death if he felt like it would be the right thing for America to do.
In your Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan books, there's Valery Volodin. He's the head of the former Soviet Union, now Russia. Mm-hmm. And in the Gray Man books, you've been critical of the CIA, show that it could be corrupted at some point, but also you very much admire people who are in the service and who give their lives over to protecting America and the free world. With this conflict that's going on now between Donald Trump and allegations of hacking by the Russians at the behest of Putin, Trump seemingly favoring Putin over the CIA's. Since you know people in the business, what are your feelings on this?
Well, my feelings on that are Trump speaks in absolutes, which I don't really understand. So his skepticism of things that he hasn't been briefed on, I can't really speak to. I don't get that at all. He's speaking favorably or using Julian Assange as something of an intelligence source now to give credence over the U.S. intelligence agencies. I don't get that at all. So it's hard for me to speak to it. Those people who say that they don't know all the facts, or, you know, we, the people, don't know all the facts about the hacking are absolutely right about that. And so I think all the facts should be known before someone makes a decision. And the way you know all the facts is meet with the intelligence people and then draw your conclusions from there. You probably just don't tweet about it on day one and then look into it from there. So I don't get that at all from sort of my understanding of how the intelligence world works. But in my books, I sort of have this skepticism for bureaucracy, not necessarily the individual people in the CIA. It's sort of when I'm critical of the CIA in the Gray Man series, I'm sort of critical of this big lumbering behemoth that doesn't necessarily think so much about the guy on the ground under fire at the tip of the spear. He's sometimes sold out by suits back in Langley when he's in the Sudan or something like that. And so not only do I think that makes really good fiction, I think there's been a lot of examples of that being the case around the world. If you really look at what happened in Benghazi, and not the political fallout and all the back and forth mumbo jumbo, but if you look at what happened to these, you know, CIA contract guys on the ground in Benghazi, they were, I won't say sold out, but let's say they were not supported as they should have been as they were under fire. So there's a million of examples of that, I think, that have gone on in history. And now everything's clouded over by which side you fall on politically. And my books don't have any sort of political lean to them at all. It's a guy on the ground hoping that the guy back in the office or the woman back in the office gives him the support that he needs to do his job.
Now, several of your Jack Ryan books have been very prescient in actions that Russia would take just a few months after publication, it seems. So how long is it before they're in the Baltic states?
It could be any time. I mean, I think if I was Vladimir Putin, I would be definitely looking at Lithuania and Estonia. Actually, Estonia more than Lithuania. But Russia could go into Belarus and make their way into Vilnius, Lithuania, in a couple of hours. It's very close to the border. And we haven't seen much pushback from NATO. And the indications are that NATO doesn't seem like it's going to be getting stronger in the next 4 years.
No tank presence in that area of the
Yeah, yeah, alliance, exactly. So. Just from what we've heard so far. So, you know, who knows how things will happen. But I do think Putin is an opportunist. And he's seen some things he's gotten away with pretty scot-free of late. And I think something will happen. In Command Authority, the last book I did with Tom before he died in 2013, we had Russia going into the Ukraine. And that book came out in December of 13. And in February of 2014, Russia invaded Ukraine. So these things do happen. And it doesn't take, you know, incredible prescience. You just sort of look at what's going on and just look out a few months in advance and say, well, this is one thing that could happen. So maybe they don't go into the Baltic. Maybe they, I don't know, do something else, put permanent bases in Syria or you know, things like that. But it's something to look for in the future. And I don't see any reason that Russia is going to become more restrained in their actions.
So what are your opinions on people who seem to, in America, who seem to be very positive toward Putin right now at the moment?
I don't get it. I do not get it. I read something about how support for Putin was 10% a few months ago, and now it's like 39% in some quarters or something, and I don't get it at all. It's that the enemy of my enemy is my friend thing, and Putin has said some nice things about the president-elect. And as a Republican myself, I guess it's a little disheartening because, you know, 4 years ago, when the Republican presidential nominee was saying that Russia was our biggest geopolitical foe, the Democrats just laughed at that. And the Republicans did, you know, who supported Romney really supported that and backed him up for that. And now that has been borne out in reality. And some people on the left who were against saying Russia was a geopolitical foe now see them as our greatest geopolitical foe. And some people on the right who definitely felt one way 4 years ago now seem to be a staunch supporter of Vladimir Putin. I would recommend they do a lot of the nonfiction I've done in the past 4 years on Putin and go over to Russia and go over to Lithuania as I have and to Poland and look at that yourself and see if you feel the same way.
It's bad on both sides of America's political divide.
I agree.
That it's almost always a case of it's okay if our guy does it.
Yeah. And where does that go down the line if we're all just trying to put our strong man in power to enact what we want? I just think historically you look at the United States, you look at any country, and the larger the divisions, the worse it is for the integrity of the union. The more division you have, the less union you have. And I think it would be great long term if we can come together a little bit more in some ways. And I hope that happens. But, you know, my books aren't really the venue to make that happen. And that's just what I hope on a personal nature.
Well, your books rely on international conflicts. So.
Yeah, they do. I don't, but you know, in my books, the bad guys are usually more or less abroad.
Well, I mean, those that were after court were inside the government themselves.
Yeah, they were. And they had reasons that weren't political reasons. They were sort of more bureaucratic, more personal, more related to cleaning up their own mistakes or their glossing over their own situations. And it wasn't this big left or right question. But I think that that is human nature. And I hope it's not human nature that, you know, this country that's been together for 250 years is tearing itself apart, as, you know, a lot of nations inevitably do.
Now let's get back to Gunmetal Gray. And it begins not with our gray man, but with a 26-year-old sergeant in the Chinese army named Fan Jiang, and he's planning to defect. What is his plan for actually bugging out?
Well, what can I say about it? He's a member of a group called Red Cell, which is in a real unit. Red Cell is my own device, but it's in a real unit of the People's Liberation Army. 61398 is the name of the department. And they are the best cyber espionage and cyber warriors that China has. And they're based in Shanghai, both in reality and in the book. And so Fan Jiang is one of their top guys. He works in a group called Red Cell, whose job it is to sort of do penetration testing of China's own network, using the things they've learned about how to penetrate America and the UK's networks, and turning them around and seeing if they can be used to exploit China's own network, to protect. Penetration testing is what it is. So he's very well placed, and he knows sort of the keys to China's digital cyber kingdom, I guess. So that makes him a very important guy because of a compromise that wasn't his fault, but a compromise that has happened to him. He decides that he has to get out of China. And when he does that, his only option that he sees is to be sort of taken in by one and then another criminal organization in Southeast Asia. As he tries to make his way to safety, he's sort of offering his services in these different criminal organizations to get protection. So the gray man has to sort of find this guy, as do other people are looking for him as well, And it's not so simple as finding this one defector running around. He is being protected by these different organizations.
And up next, we meet a couple of Chinese government hitters who have gone into Hong Kong. What is kind of the political situation now for administrating Hong Kong within the Chinese government?
It's called a special administrative region, but Hong Kong is part of China now. It's part of Greater China. You know, they say one country, two systems. They have all these slogans. Officially, my understanding is Chinese intelligence is not supposed to work inside Hong Kong without notifying the Hong Kong government. But in this book, the rules are thrown out because China is very, very motivated. The People's Liberation Army and the whole Ministry of Defense is extremely motivated to find Fan Jiang before he falls into the hands of the Americans or any other actor out there looking for him. So the gloves are off and China sort of floods the zone of Hong Kong, desperate to find this guy that they know has escaped, and they know he has all these secrets in his head. So I think in reality that would probably happen. Someone with the who could be as big a compromise as Fan Jiang, if he made his way into Hong Kong, I think the official rule book would be thrown out the window, and the Chinese would have somebody on every street corner looking for him.
Tell us about the hitters. They have a lot of personality.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I wanted to create them not just sort of stereotypical cliche Chinese government hitmen guys. I wanted them to have interesting banter between the two of them. It's funny when I read books, sometimes people are culturally different, then sometimes they're written a little bit wooden or a little bit stilted, just as you would think that if they were speaking to you in English, that would be how they actually speak to one another. If that makes sense, what I'm saying is sometimes their dialogue's a little more rudimentary and their thoughts are a little more rudimentary because you, as the writer, you're picturing them communicating with you or you witnessing them communicate. But the reality is, if they're speaking Mandarin, they probably have a pretty robust vocabulary and are willing to talk a lot more and go into more depth. And so that was just interesting to me to play with these two characters. One of them is very focused on the mission. The other is very much excited about the mission and looking forward to the opportunity to maybe kill a CIA operative because that's sort of been his goal. There's a little bit of a witty banter between them. There's also a very dark banter between them. And all the while, it's a way that the reader can learn about who's actually after Fan Jiang without me as the author like narrating that to them, you know, in the exposition, so that you learn about who Colonel Dai Long Hai is, who is the actual head of this unit that's after Fan Jiang and ultimately after Court Gentry as well.
And we learn that Colonel Dai, his opponent may be the CIA, but his mission is CYA.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Colonel Dai was one of the people in charge of keeping Fan Jiang inside China. So when Fan Jiang turns up in Hong Kong, Colonel Dai's boss is put in front of a firing squad, and Colonel Dai is now made the boss and said, you know, and told that he needs to go find this guy and bring him back. And he has all these resources at his disposal. So, yeah, Colonel Dai, I think there's a line in there that this isn't going to get him promoted or get him advanced in his career. Successfully completing this mission will sort of keep him alive and allow him to go back to his job.
How integrated are the Chinese intelligence agencies? America, we've talked about before, has just this alphabet soup of intelligence and security agencies. Is Chinese intelligence security more integrated than America's is?
Yeah, I don't know. At the beginning of this book, you definitely see the Ministry of Defense, Colonel Dai is a member of that, being in charge of the mission, but also the intelligence ministry as being integrated with them because they have these just different assassins that are working under him. And the whole point of that was that this is such a big operation, this is so important that they get Fan Jiang back, that they're throwing out all the stops. It wouldn't have made sense to me if Colonel Dai had come into Hong Kong with a dozen guys, you know, from the defense ministry or a dozen, you know, army units or SWAT teams or something like that. This is bigger than that, and the risks are bigger. So basically Beijing has said, listen, it's your job to get this guy back. Take whoever you want or whoever you need. So he's brought assassins from the Interior Ministry or the intelligence sector, and he's got all sorts of sources. As the story goes through different countries, he's working with the embassies in those countries, and he's got intelligence officers and sort of surveillance guys pulled out of these embassies. And it just shows that Colonel Dai has complete command authority over this entire operation. And that was less to show how integrated they are in real life and more to show how important the stakes were in this story of getting Fan Jiang back.
And now with Gentry having at least some backing of the CIA, He's not having to do everything himself and improvise his plans constantly, but as soon as he gets to Hong Kong, he's made.
Yes, page one, or I guess page one is sort of the setup of, or the prologue is sort of the setup of Fan leaving China, and then chapter one, page one, Court Gentry appears, and his whole cover is blown on page one. And I just thought, you know, it's real important to me as I do these books, because as I said before, I'm a big reader, and I love reading different series, and I love to see things that don't cover ground that you've covered before in a series. And so I haven't opened a book with the hero being compromised at the beginning. And so it just seemed like a different way to, you know, to cover new ground. And so from day one, he has to sort of reprove his legend, because it's very important that the Chinese think that he's there for another reason. So when they identify this guy as being an officer for the CIA, the second that he gets off his plane, he has to come up with a way to clean up that whole mess and reintroduce himself to this group. And it sounds really complicated. Hopefully it's fun in the story, because it creates a lot of action. It creates a lot of tension from page one. But I just thought it would be something different to do. Challenge as a writer, like, how do you sell that? His whole operation hinges on the Chinese not knowing who he's working for. And then on page one, it looks like they know who he's working for. So he kind of starts this mission in the hole, so to speak.
And it's a bit different, because since he's so blandly Caucasian in his appearance, mm-hmm. that works to his advantage in America and operating in Europe and to some extent Latin America. But in Asia, he really doesn't have that advantage available to him.
Trust me, thriller writers who write in my genre think about that all the time. There's a million places that I want to put Court Gentry or Jack Ryan Jr. even more in when I do the Tom Clancy books. And you scratch your head and you say, okay, I can probably sell this to the reader, but how many pages will I spend trying to sell this conceit to the reader? Yeah, you do think about it. And there's always reasons to put a Caucasian guy in some strange place. They're not always good reasons, but, you know, pretty soon I will have exhausted all of them. But this is one where Hong Kong, there's a lot of civilians. There's actually, I can't remember the number now because it's been a while since I researched this book, but there's actually quite a few British people who retained or took citizenship in, you know, have Hong Kong passports to this day, even though it was the 90s, you know, when it was given back to China. So there are ways around that. But yeah, that becomes part of your work when your hero looks a certain way. One of the easy things is he grows a beard. I mean, obviously not for his, you know, ethnicity, but, you know, this cover status, there's a few things a guy can do to look a little bit different. But if I have him working in the Congo, or if I have him working in Southeast Asia, as the case here, there has to be reason that this particular guy is here to where he doesn't stand out. And if you're the gray man, that gets tough.
And I thought one of the nice tradecraft details you had is that Court in his hotel lingered down in the restaurant downstairs because he knew they would be searching his room, and he didn't want to, like, force a confrontation by going back early.
Yeah, he knows enough about what's going on. He knows he's been made, and he knows that the reasonable thing for them to do while he's having dinner is for these guys to be upstairs tearing up his room. I actually spent some time in hotels in Beijing, and the business class hotels there are all bugged. That doesn't mean they're listening to you at all times, but they have the ability to. And I thought, I was staying in a hotel in Beijing, and I was thinking, how low on the spy totem pole are you if you're listening in to my bathroom here in the Novotel on whatever street? You know, that's like, this poor Chinese guy probably wanted to be the next James Bond, and it's his job to listen, you know, to me flush the toilet. That's pretty low on the totem pole. But thinking about that as the hero, he knows tradecraft and he knows these regular standard protocols of things enough to where he figures these guys are upstairs checking his room out to see who he is. And so he dawdles over dinner to give them as much time as possible, because the last thing he wants to do is go up there and accidentally interrupt them, because then he, under the cover of a businessman, which is what he's trying to do, he would have to create a big stink and he'd have to go down and complain to the manager and all these other things. And he just basically wanted to go to bed. So, yeah, he gives them plenty of time, has an extra beer or two so they can have time to shake him down.
Now, a name from his past becomes very important in this operation, and it's Sir Donald Fitzroy.
Yeah, the very first Gray Man book, Don Fitzroy was Court's handler, the guy that got him his contracts. He was a private assassin at the time, a freelance assassin. And Sir Donald has showed up in the first book, a little bit in the second book. I think he's been referred to a few other times, but no major parts. But in this book, he's kind of key, because the reader learns pretty quickly that Sir Donald Fitzroy has been kidnapped by the Chinese because they are using him
He owns a security company, but is basically a cover front for a cadre of private assassins. So the Chinese know this, and they have Sir Donald working for them, trying to find Fan Jiang. But Sir Donald's men had been unsuccessful to date. So they are turning the screws on Sir Donald to work a little bit harder and sort of putting his life on the line, kidnapping him to where he does this. And that's court's entree into the situation.
Now, the Chinese government and the CIA aren't the only people looking for Fan Jiang. And later on, we meet a Russian operative named Zoya Zakharova. And I think it was when your last Jack Ryan book came out, someone was complaining about a woman being involved in a fight in the book.
Yeah.
They're going to go nuts having her.
I know.
A woman who knows how to use a gun, for goodness sake.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you get these emails from people. And even though 98% of the correspondences I hear from fans are fantastic, it's those 2% that just you think about all day long. And sometimes they're absolutely right. I've had people complain about me in some ways, and I'll read the email and I'll be like, yeah, I could totally have a beer with that guy and pile on my own writing and be like, yeah, here's another thing I did wrong, you know, and totally get along with that guy. But every now and then you get somebody and you just think that they're just a crackpot. So people have sort of complained that a female had a large role in the last Tom Clancy book I did. And she was based on real people, and she was based on things that actually, I understand, have happened in the special operations community as far as like using females in certain roles. She wasn't a ninja, you know, she wasn't anything like, and if she were, that would probably be fine too. But anyway, yeah, in this book, you have a female SVR, Russian intelligence operative, who is very tactically sound, has great tradecraft, just a ton of experience. As you learn a little bit of it about her history throughout the story, you dig into that a little bit more. But yeah, I've had strong female characters in a lot of my books, but maybe nobody as strong as Zoya Zakharova.
There's also a lot of Asian organized crime activity in the book, and you name syndicates in different countries. Are those the actual names of those syndicates, or did you have to create kind of stand-ins?
I created stand-ins. I did a ton of research on organized crime in Vietnam and Thailand and Cambodia and a couple other places. So the locations they're in, sort of the tactics and the headquarters and how they work with the police and all those sort of things were based on research I've done. But the two organizations, the two main organizations, the Shamroon Syndicate in Thailand and the Wild Tigers, Khon Ho Hoang Da in Vietnam, those are my creations, but based on different things. I took, you know, the most interesting things out of different organizations and created them.
I was thinking about your books, with the Gray Man books and the Jack Ryan books, and is that you have to kind of moderate the outcomes of the books. No victory can be so complete as to get too far away from the geopolitical reality that we're inhabiting right now, that everything kind of has to be a bit compromised because you can't get too far divorced from reality.
That is true. That is part of it. And you're absolutely right that part of it is, you know, if you had Jack Ryan in a Jack Ryan book totally defeating Russia and turning them around to, you know, NATO members and staunch allies of the United States, and together we work together to wipe out ISIS or whatever, that would, you know, two books down the road in this series, you would be scratching your head because the people that read the books two books later don't understand this whole, you know, the geopolitical world is very, very different. But another aspect of it, of why I do that in these books, is because that's just sort of how the real world is. And it's just interesting to me that not every ending is perfectly happy or perfectly set. I've had complaints from readers before. They're like, wow, you really left that book with a cliffhanger. And I don't even know what they mean by a cliffhanger. It's like, well, the good guys won, but they didn't win so completely that it's not like the Death Star blew up at the end or something like that. You know, it's not that level of resolution, but I just feel like that sort of mirrors life a little bit. I still think the stories have really satisfactory outcomes for the heroes, or, you know, complete outcomes for the heroes and the readers. But yeah, you're right. You don't want to get too far away at the end of your book if you're going to write another one about what's actually going on in the world.
Yeah, it seems like the victories have to be more tactical than strategic.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The huge strategic victories are terrific. And if I was doing a NATO war book or something like that, you know, getting Russia back to the Russian border or something like that, that might be good enough. But yeah, tactically, you can win the day at the end of the book. But if you completely win everything, and I don't know, it just doesn't seem realistic to me, unfortunately.
Now, of course, you're still writing Jack Ryan books for the Tom Clancy estate. And the most recent one is True Faith and Allegiance.
New York Times bestseller yet again.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit what the plot of that one is?
Yeah. So True Faith and Allegiance is my seventh. I did three with Tom before he died, and this is my fourth since he passed away. Basically, the crux of this story is, again, taken from the real world. In the real world, the Office of Personnel Management, U.S. Government Department, was hacked a few years ago by the Chinese in reality, and 20-something million classified intelligence applications called an SF-86 form were stolen by the Chinese. And so that's the application that everyone in the U.S. government has ever filled out since the early 80s to apply for classified intelligence status. So in my book, a different actor takes these and figures out how to weaponize this often old information by using social media, by using other hacking techniques and other targeting intelligence tactics to create these targeting packages for America's soldiers and spies. So suddenly, on page one of the book, every military or contractor or spy or State Department official, their personnel information is known to some bad actors in the world, and that's been weaponized. And so President Jack Ryan and his son, Jack Ryan Jr., who's an intelligence officer for a group called The Campus, they are pitted against this big conspiracy to target individuals across the United States in the military and intelligence circle. So it's this big sweeping geopolitical story that has a lot of bad actors and conspiracy together and a lot of good guys trying to fight their way out of this horrible intelligence compromise.
So with so much of intelligence now kind of shifting to the cyber world, what is it like for you, a guy who write stories about people who carry guns and shoot, have to kind of put more emphasis on that?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of, you know, human intelligence stuff still going on, of course. But I've done books on cyber warfare, quite Threat Vector, which was the second Tom Clancy book I did, was very exclusively cyber warfare. You know, obviously, there's a lot of action involved with it as well. Support and Defend, another Clancy book I did, had a good cyber aspect. And then this one. But there's still a ton of human operations, a lot of direct action, a lot of military. So all the cyber sleuthing or cyber warfare in the world only really becomes dangerous when it is turned into something kinetic, even if that's overflowing a dam or turning the cooling towers off at a nuclear plant and all those cyber aspects of kinetic. That creates very real tension and real world action. But also, a lot of this cyber stuff can only be combated with guys on the ground, guys, guns, and gates. So there's still a lot of action and kinetic stuff. You can have your story that has sort of a cyber aspect of it, but it's a little bit of a MacGuffin. And I know you know what that is, and I guess most people know a MacGuffin is just sort of, I don't know, give me your 5-second definition of MacGuffin. It'll be better than mine.
It's the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
But what are you going after? But does that thing ultimately matter in and of itself?
Right, exactly. So it's the thing that it
drives the action.
It drives
but it
the
may
action.
Not be important.
Perfect.
In and of itself.
I've come here to get my answer on how to give a 10-second version on what a MacGuffin is. And so, yeah, a lot of times the cyber aspect of it is important to the story. So it's not completely a MacGuffin, but it's the thing that drives the action, but it's not the action itself.
Now, are you going to be able to keep up the two-book-a-year pace for the years coming up?
I am going to keep up a two-book-a-year pace. I only have done one-book-at-a-time contracts with the Tom Clancy world, so we'll see what's coming up ahead for that. I am doing two books this year. Right now, I'm writing the next Gray Man book, which at this point it's called Weaponize, unless someone tells me it has a different title. But for
you
now,
you mean Court Gentry survives this book?
Well, yeah, that's something you have to go into. It might be someone else. And then I'm going to write another book with a friend of mine who's in the military. I'm actually going to do a research trip in Poland and Germany and France here in a couple weeks, and I'll start working on that one as well. So I will be doing two books this year at least, and then we'll see what happens for the Tom Clancy world as well.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by and sharing Gunmetal Gray with us.
Always enjoy it, Stephen. Thank you.
Mark Greene is the author of Gunmetal Gray, the sixth book in the Court Gentry Gray Man series, which is published by Berkeley. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.